This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. This series, we're on the trail of the bold and the brazen. Women who dared to step out of the life laid out for them. Sometimes just to survive, but sometimes to thrive. In this episode, we'll travel back over 200 years to revisit some of our lady swindlers and bring them into the present. We're going to take a look at their lives, a feminist look actually, and we're going to ask, is anything so very different today? Just before we begin, the cases we're going to discuss are covered in previous episodes of this series of Lady Swindlers. So if you haven't already listened, there are spoilers ahead. Our Lady Swindlers are fearless.
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
They are audacious.
I am Violet Charlesworth. I am the girl who has had adventures that are without number, who is at once romantic, daring and demure.
They are proud.
Everybody was acquainted with my whole history. The wharves were covered with people to see me.
And some of them are stars.
With diamond rings on her fingers and fox furs round her neck. I thought she looked like a film star.
Glamorous. Now, with me in the studio is our fantastic in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, who will transport us back to the past. Welcome, Roz.
Hello, Lucy.
And today we're joined by our guest detective, Helen Lewis, author of Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights, and a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. Welcome back to our Lady Universe, Helen.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to get my deerstalker on and my magnifying glass out and look into these cases.
In Lady Killers, we had women who came face to face with death. In Lady Swindlers, though, we have women who squeeze the juice out of life. They get fame in their lifetimes. Some of them get fortune. And I guess as we're still talking about them, they all get a kind of immortality. Helen and Roz, if you aspired to immortality, how would you go about achieving it?
I think you need to do something that they're going to build a statue of you over. And that's quite tough if you're a woman. Looking around London where we're recording this, there's really very few. There's some heroic nurses. I think maybe that my late turn into heroic nursing might be my best bet, I think.
Are you keen on statues as a record of immortality, though? It seems to be they're kind of a bit of a 20th century concept. They're not cool art. Are any statues made today going to survive the test of time?
I too am a statue sceptic because quite often they get put up for very political reasons, not necessarily straightforwardly patriotic ones, but a well-deployed statue I'm okay with.
Okay, a statue for Helen. What about you, Roz?
Well, I think my answer is probably a little less controversial. I would like to contribute something to our knowledge of the past, specifically the 19th century, that is still there as part of our corpus of understanding in 100 years' time.
That's such a swotty answer,
I know,
Roz.
Sorry.
You're going to be worshipped by the nerds of the future, Roz, and well deservedly so. Now, let's imagine for a moment that our Lady Swindlers were alive today. Let's think about how they might be covered by today's newspapers and social media, even if they might be on social media themselves. Now, Helen, Roz secretly thinks that this is a totally ahistorical game that we're going to play, but it's going to be fun, so she's going to go along with it. Are you up for imagining our Lady Swindlers dealing with today's media?
I am, and I think it's interesting that they come from a time in which we were beginning to see international press attention.
My dear friend and benefactress, the English papers were out here before ourselves.
most of these women did have quite a strong sense of who they were and the image they wanted to project to the world. This is why I think it's not a kind of ridiculous concept, because everything about social media is about turning yourself into a personal brand. So they were kind of early adopters in that sense.
Absolutely. The lives of all of our lady swindlers involve reinvention and life as a kind of performance art, I suppose, pretending to be something different when in public. Mary Baker's relaunch starts in April 1817, when she decides she's done with a life full of hardship, and overnight she becomes Princess Caribou. She just shows up in the village of Almondsbury, Bristol, wearing what appears to be an Asiatic costume and speaking an imaginary foreign language. She fools a whole village for 10 weeks, living a lavish life as a fake princess. Now, Helen, over to you. Let's start with Princess Caribou. How do you imagine that her life would play out online now, today?
Well, surprisingly enough, I wrote an article a couple of years ago about female academics who were passing themselves off as different races.
Ooh, this is Rachel
Dolezal, who had white parents but has passed herself off as black and also had worked for the NAACP, which is the pro-black advocacy group. So she wasn't just someone who was coincidentally passing herself off as black. She had really embraced that identity. She started curling her hair and fake tanning, and she had this level of empathy that turned into her thinking, in some ways, I'm sort of spiritually black. I wonder, is Mary Baker a flat-out fraud who was doing this for attention, for money, as a grift? Or was there some part of her that was drawn to the idea that this was a kind of more authentic way of life? Where do you land on this one, Roz?
Definitely not in it for the money at all, because she didn't make any money from this. She's not in it either as a form of expression of identity. I don't think Mary Baker felt that she was genuinely part of a different ethnicity or culture. She has an interesting backstory in that she's quite a performer and she likes to fantasize about life and make things up. So for me, Princess Caribou, it's about genuinely, I can have a different life. I want to perform. I really should be on the stage.
I think she would be an absolute natural for TikTok.
She oftentimes carried a gong on her back and a tambourine in her hand, her head dressed with flowers and feathers, and thus she made it appear she was prepared for war.
The fact that she had the kind of costume and she had the persona, I think Princess Caribou was very appealing there.
Can you imagine that there'd be a tidal wave of hatred and cancellation though when it came out that she wasn't really a princess?
Oh, absolutely. I think the weird thing is there would probably be also some people who would cling on forever to the idea that sort of truther movement, which you always get on the internet. People saying maybe there's something that the mainstream media aren't telling you. Maybe she really is a princess.
And maybe she could reinvent herself as an ex-fake princess.
Yeah, I think the shamelessness is very highly rewarded on social media. There's a phrase they call posting through it. And maybe and that's what she would have done. She would have posted through it and come out the other side.
About 100 years later in North Wales, we have the fake heiress, Violet Charlesworth, who, on the eve of inheriting a fictional fortune, stages a dramatic car crash and disappears. She then reappears as a Scottish woman called Margaret MacLeod, and she denies her past as Violet Charlesworth. Ooh, she'd be good online, wouldn't she, Helen? What do you think?
I can imagine her on Instagram showing off all of her bling. There's a genre both on Instagram and YouTube called the unboxing video, which is that you get some new bit of swag and you make a big deal and you tap your nails on it in this ASMR way and you show people off, you know, all of the luxurious stuff that you've got. And I think she would do a great job of surrounding herself with all the bits of things that she'd been given for free or the loans that she'd taken out to create this facade like an influencer, that everything was so much better than it actually was. It's all a very carefully constructed kind of artifice. And clearly she was very good at that too.
I think you've said it beautifully, Helen. I think that Charlesworth, in some ways, was living in the wrong era for her. She would have been such a great Instagrammer. It would have helped her fraud no end.
I can also imagine her in Tatler magazine or the World of Interiors showing off the inside decor of her house, or perhaps the Financial Times' How to Spend It magazine, which is always a great way to find out about what jewellery and fast cars and champagne and great lifestyle accoutrements people have.
The swiftness, the power, the ease, the sense of command woke in me feelings which it is almost impossible to explain. The motor car was to me a thing of life. I think the poetry of the machine affected me.
Then we have two daring swindlers who lived at the same time during the 1920s, but on opposite sides of the world. We have Alice Diamond in London, who ran the all-female shoplifting syndicate called the 40 Elephants, and Tilly Devine in Sydney, Australia. Let's start with the Queen of the 40 Thieves, Alice Diamond. Now, I'm struggling a bit with the idea of her online, because she didn't want to get caught, obviously, as a shoplifter. So she wouldn't go, hooray, I'm a shoplifter online, would she?
I think she might have at some point done her Repentance of a Justified Sinner memoir. She could have done a brilliant How I Got Myself Out of My Life of Crime memoir, because she had that kind of capacity, I think, teaching other people and for talking about what she did in an interesting way. But you're right, if you're a shoplifter, the one thing you absolutely don't want is anyone to know what your face looks like.
Yeah, for this one, I was thinking a little bit of a different social media, maybe encrypted WhatsApp, in order to plan things with her gang to pass the messages around. Because it was very important for her gang to be tightly knit and all in it together. So you'd need to be in contact with each other. Where are the goods going? Who's looking after their modification to sell them on? Where's the agent in the shop who's looking at us?
That's very interesting, because when we talk about social media, we usually think about public social media, the ones you see. But there is this whole subterranean layer of, as you say, WhatsApp being the most popular, Telegram, Signal, ones that are encrypted, and also they delete everything. And you can put on an auto-delete function. And if you're running a criminal gang, using an encrypted messaging service that destroys all the evidence on a regular basis would probably be the one that you'd go for.
So we think that she would be very active, but also very private, as a true swindler probably should be, really. Helen, you've just made a whole series about how we communicate online and on instant messaging called Influenced. Helen Lewis has left the chat. It's on Radio 4. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I've been really fascinated by the fact that we talk so much about public social media, and I don't think we've had the same conversation about what I think of as private social media. It's a big issue in elections, misinformation being spread in the ways that you can't see. The Ukraine war has been the site of a huge amount of propaganda pumped out by both sides, spread through encrypted services like Signal and Telegram. British politics would be nothing without the WhatsApp group. And these are replacements often for gossip, because everybody is now so geographically distant from one another. They have fundamentally changed the way that we relate to each other.
I'm with you there. Finally, we have the queen of the Sydney underworld, Tilly Devine, with her network of brothels, the commander of a violent gang that changed the face of the city.
There are lots in Sydney who will miss me, even the police.
What do you think about her, Helen?
I find her fascinating, the way that she built herself up. I think the interesting thing about her is finding a woman's place in that underworld and turning herself into a kind of feared and respected figure. I don't know. I almost wonder if she's got the brazenness enough to be on X, formerly Twitter. I don't know. I can sort of see her having a kind of alt account where she leaves mean messages on other people's anonymously. That's why I think I'd probably peg her for that one.
She was quite close to senior police officers as well. So you can imagine her perhaps hiding in plain sight, do you think, Roz?
Yeah, I had a similar thought to you, Helen, actually, on this one. I was wondering if she would have used a social media platform like X to goad her enemies, her rivals, to really poke at them. Because she had a rival with another crime boss called Kate Lee, and I could just imagine this kind of rivalry going on that level. It doesn't really refer to their crimes as such, but really poking each other.
Yeah, I like that idea. I think probably an anonymous social media account would be a good idea if you're also running a drug ring. That would be my recommendation to anybody in those circumstances.
World of crypto, maybe.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. Actually, now, what is the modern version of her? And, you know, there are vast untraceable sums of money being moved around by people who think that they want to stay outside the banks. You know, maybe, I don't know if you've ever followed this, but there was a big phase of launching new fake coins and in schemes that were so-called pump and dump schemes. So you create a type of cryptocurrency, then you talked it up a huge amount, and then you sold off your stake in it. And I wonder if she would have had Tilly Coin, Divine Coin. They sound very good, like branding efforts, don't they? And she would have, you know, she would have cashed out her money into that, into a way that was untouchable and untraceable.
Helen, do you think that women get treated in a different way than men do?
Absolutely, there is a double standard. Not one that is always to women's disadvantage, I should have to say, which is that sometimes your own innate glamour is seen to glamorise your crime. That suddenly is kind of transmuted into this mythology rather than being treated as a kind of mundane act of violence.
Bars named after her, that sort of thing.
Which is very strange to me. I don't know how you feel about this, Roz, but there's a sort of statute of limitation on crime. After a certain amount of time, people feel okay to sort of romanticise what were objectively very horrible incidents.
Oh, Roz never romanticises anything. She's always down on the criminal.
Oh, Lucy. Yes, no, I completely agree with that. It's very easy with the passage of time to adopt an idea of, well, this was a woman expressing agency and breaking out and everything, and therefore we overlook the harm that they've done. We do need to check ourselves sometimes when we are studying these characters in the past.
I hear you, but I'm going to embrace some double standards here and say I do really love the glamorous murderess Maria Manning. I like her. I think she's cool.
I think there are stories of female pirates where you just think you had moxie, and I respect that. And
there you go, you're doing it too.
It's true.
And Roz is looking disapproving.
No, not at all.
Now, Roz, I'm curious about who tells our swindlers' stories. We don't always get it from the horse's mouth, do we? Or we can't necessarily believe the horse.
Yeah, that's right. We have a bit of a mixed bag. So we have Charlesworth. She attempts to tell her own story. She gives press interviews, but arguably those male reporters apply their own spin when it goes into print. You can see in there some anxiety that's coming out about the increasing freedoms for women at the time, what Charlesworth might represent. They also emphasise her femininity and try to take the sting out of her crime by emphasising her femininity. Caribou's the other one to pull out here. A male journalist, John Matthew Gutch, tells her story. He bases it on an interview with her, but he controls the narrative. So, for example, in 1813, Caribou, or Mary Baker as she's known then, supposedly enters a place for penitent prostitutes. Now, Mary Baker swears that she wasn't a prostitute, but still the suggestion remains. Prostitution was a common strategy that was used by poor women to survive. But also we've got to be very careful because, especially when we have the interference of men telling stories, prostitution starts to become a common theme. And we wonder, are they putting some kind of spin on it? Are they making assumptions? Are they fantasizing in a different way about these women's lives?
I do notice sex work coming up time and time again in the backgrounds of these swindlers. And I'm interested to know where Helen stands on sex work. Do you think it's work just like any other kind?
No, I don't. I recently interviewed probably the highest paid escort in the world currently when I was over in Austin, who makes thousands and thousands of dollars and gets to pick her clients very carefully. I find it very hard to sort of be morally disapproving about that, but there is so much pain and misery at the bottom end of it. And it's interesting to me that Tilly Devine came up through street sex work, which is traditionally the most dangerous and most low paid. You don't have a lot of choice over who you go with. You don't get paid very well. It's very hard to insist on people using protection. She was really doing the most potentially violent and difficult type of sex work. So yeah, I think when you look historically, we're often looking at survival. But I'm interested in Roz saying that because one of the things that is interesting about Rachel Dolezal, our race baker in modern times, is she's ended up starting an OnlyFans, which is an online account for selling saucy pictures of oneself, shall we say. And I think there is always, when women are seen to be living on the edges of society, an interest in whether or not that means that they are also sexually available. And it's of a piece with the idea of a woman who is not really part of respectable society, that perhaps sex might be a part of that picture too.
Mm. Are you saying that after she became sort of pushed out of society, that she turned to that?
Yeah, it's interesting that this is one of the few kind of career options that is open to women when everything else has been closed off. I would be interested in whether or not, to what level of agency we should describe the women that we're talking about going into sex work. But I think there's also the other thing, which is what Roz was saying, which is people want these women to be sexually available because it's an exciting part of the mythology.
Yes.
You know, they want them to be sexual outlaws in the same way that they are outlaws in regard to stealing, for example.
Well, so what do you think?
I have a real pet hate, and that's when people talk about prostitution being the oldest profession in the world. There's a real danger in doing that, as there is a danger in thinking about sex work as a profession, because it takes the focus away from the context which gives rise to this job or to this phenomenon. And so I like to imagine a different world where women don't necessarily have to do that work or feel that that is a good choice.
Where they don't want to, because there are just much better options. Now, while Tilly Devine is getting her rivals razored in Australia, Alice Diamond on the other side of the world is enjoying life by exploiting the latest shopping trends and the rise of a new type of consumerism with women at its heart. Helen, often women get sold things on the grounds that it will empower them. What do you think about that? Is that always a scam?
It's always a scam. Yeah.
At this moment, I'm wearing red lipstick. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel powerful. That's... Am I, in fact, deluded? Am I being scammed?
I don't think you're deluded. I think that's fine. But if someone said to you, Lucy, you can have a job or you can have red lipstick, I'm pretty confident you pick the job, right?
Touché.
So I think it's always about economic empowerment, and economic empowerment gives you choices. And one of those is the choice to change your appearance in the way that you might like.
Mm. Now, crime seems to pay for all of these women, and they're not even hiding it.
Of course crime pays. It's getting caught that's the effing problem.
Our lady swindlers didn't just step outside gender roles, some of them also stepped over class boundaries. Ross, what do you think crime gave these women that they couldn't otherwise get with their background stories?
Yeah, what crime was giving these women was options, opportunities, a chance to change the circumstances into which they had been born. So if you take Charlesworth and Alice Diamond, for example, these were two women who were coming of age just after the turn of the 20th century. And this was a really interesting time in women's history. We see new opportunities opening up in terms of careers for the middle classes, white-collar work for the working classes and better pay, new forms of leisure, for example, the cinema, women's magazines, dancing, and fashion. But it's fair to say that some groups of women really struggled to realise these opportunities. So Charlesworth came from a lower middle-class family in a provincial town, and her prospects were quite narrow. Maybe she could have been a shop girl or a clerical worker for a time, but she would have been expected to marry someone of a similar class. And so that strategy devised by her mother to fake it until you make it, it gave her access to a different life, to motor cars, to fancy clothes, to even speculating on the stock market. And Diamond, she came from the very poorest section of society who couldn't realise the opportunities that were opening up for other sections of the working class. They had very limited opportunities. But they wanted access to money, fashion, leisure. And so we see forms of casual shoplifting, but also more professional forms of shoplifting.
Helen, do you believe that class in Britain today still controls your life outcomes?
It has a huge effect. We finally have a majority of the cabinet who went to a state school. Only 7% of Britons go to private schools, but they, including me, are vastly overrepresented in all kinds of professions. And one of the things that really struck me when you were covering Princess Caribou was, you know, they find her and she looks pretty down and out and they think, oh, this is just another kind of vagrant. And then as soon as they hear, oh, no, hang on, she's a princess, despite the fact that nothing about her material conditions has changed, suddenly there is an assumption that she is a superior kind of person. And it's a reminder, you know, all the phrases that were used about class at that time, you know, people of quality, for example, there was an idea of somehow kind of inherently God-ordained class system in Britain at that time, that people just really did ascribe to this idea of just some people were better than others in a way that today we would play lip service to egalitarianism, even if our society is still deeply marked by class in all sorts of ways. But when Moroz was talking about these liminal lives, it did make me think about women writers. And I'm obsessed with women writers. From the first professional writer in English, who's a woman, Aphra Behn, she lived this very classless life in that she transcended those boundaries. Writing, just like crime, was a way that gave women a chance to step outside of the boundaries that would otherwise have constrained them.
That's a very good point, actually. Yes, yes, yes. They step outside class, I suppose. Now, in Princess Caribou's case, though, you could argue she was using race to trump class. She was wearing what appeared to be an Asiatic turban. We'd call it cultural appropriation. But at the time, she was found exotic and different and more worthy because of it. Ross, how much do you think our fake Princess Mary Baker was conscious of what she was doing?
Yeah, I think she was certainly playing on the desires of those around her, in particular Mrs. Worrell and her company, for a taste of the exotic. And she's really clever in the way that she sustains her deception as well. She's learning from them, basically, and what their expectations are of an exotic princess from the Far East, and she's playing those back to them in her role.
There is a saying that the best thing to do is always be from somewhere else. People find you much more kind of interesting and exotic. I have to say, when I read Violet Charlesworth's story about her fake Tam O'Shanter tartan embrace, it reminded me of the fact that one of Taylor Swift's dancers, a very lovely young man called Cam Saunders, posted a picture of himself at her Edinburgh shows, decked out head to toe in tartan. And the caption underneath said, "I was very worried that I might be culturally appropriating tartan, but I was reassured by the salesman this was absolutely fine." And I put it on Twitter, and almost every single one of my Scottish followers were like, "Oh yeah, I bet he reassured them," as the tills were ringing. I find the whole concept of cultural appropriation fascinating. It relies on a set of ideas about power that are very modern. Much of what we now think of modern Scottish culture was a sort of a 19th century invention. It was a kind of set of romantic ideas that were leaned into.
Absolutely. Let's end now with a question for you both. Do you think that these women fulfilled their potential? Do you think that their lives would have been very different today? Helen, what do you think?
No, I don't think they did. I think even if you just look at something as fundamental as literacy, I'd be very interested to know what level of literacy and schooling all of these women were able to achieve. All of them incredibly smart, clearly, in their different ways, and particularly those of them who managed to run an illegal business, I think now might be able to run a probably unethical but legal business. So they haven't achieved their potential.
What do you think, Roz?
I would say that all four of them did notable things. They achieved some degree of fame, which is why we're here talking about them today. But after their criminal careers or swindling careers peaked, it was really all downhill. So, for example, Diamond and Divine ended up impoverished. Princess Caribou really failed to capitalise on her fame and ended up married to a leech farmer. Charlesworth didn't finish her book, didn't get the money for it, ended up in prison, and then we have no trace of her at all. I would like to think that their lives might have been different had they lived today. We live in a different society with many more opportunities. But still, it's fair to say that so many fail to realise those opportunities because of persistent barriers. And still, there are women who, for a variety of reasons, aspire to a different life and resort to swindling of various types to achieve it.
I guess in my dreams, I'd like to imagine Alice Diamond today as the CEO of an all-female company making and selling wonderful shoes. I think that Violet Charlesworth could be a very good influencer, unboxing things. And I can see Princess Caribou as a successful performance artist. But it does seem to me that Tilly Devine would probably have stayed on the wrong side of the law. She was a real bad un, wasn't she? That's what I'd like to think. But I fear this. Inequality and its rise might mean that they would have lived just as much in society's shadowy, swindly margins. A huge thank you to our guest detective Helen Lewis and our historical consultant Rosalind Crone. Next time, we're heading stateside to meet the reformed con woman Sophie Lyons, who tries to convince people that crime doesn't pay. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Reham Musa, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhianne Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series by searching for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside.
In order to understand the deep state, you must understand the organizations within the deep state.
As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, where the storming of the Capitol was a setup and the institutions of the state are a facade.
It's all an illusion.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.